Five News.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. It's Food Wednesday. Later in the broadcast, what we can learn about Afghanistan from families making carpets in a remote village there. But first, 80 years ago, a Virginia family started a small pork packing company along the Jamestown River in Smithfield. Today, that company, which is now the largest pork producer in the world, may soon pass into the hands of Chinese owners. China's most prominent meat producer, Shuanghui, is set to buy Smithfield Foods in a $4.7 billion deal, expected to be China's most expensive American purchase yet. But the deal has many Americans squeamish. While Smithfield owners claim the buyout would only increase exports to China, many find it hard to forget headlines about China's tainted milk, adulterated meat, and most recently, 20,000 dead pigs floating in a river near Shanghai. So what happens if a Chinese company does take over Smithfield ham? Joining us to discuss this is Corby Kummer. He is a food writer and senior editor at The Atlantic Magazines. He joins us from studios in Boston. Corby Kummer, good to have you.
It's good to be here.
Corby, Shuanghui, the company hoping to buy Smithfield, had a less than perfect record. But allow me to back up for a second and talk in broader terms about China ramping up its investment abroad. According to the research firm known as the Rhodium Group, Chinese investment in American companies could reach an all-time high this year. But can you explain why China's biggest American purchase yet might be a pork producer?
Sure. I think that it's best to understand this in terms of technology transfer, that a lot of what China wants is access to slaughtering and processing machinery that they don't have an American industry does. And, you know, so many Chinese purchases are about gaining access to technology and pole vaulting ahead when they have the manpower, they have the land, and they certainly have the capacity in terms of raising animals. They just haven't gotten the technological systems that Smithfield does and the U.S. does. And so this is their way of ramping up for the enormously increased demand that the Chinese growing middle class has to eat more protein and to eat more meat.
Shuanghui, the company hoping to buy Smithfield, has a less than perfect track record on food safety. A couple of years back, its pork products were found to have traces of clenbuterol, a growth enhancing chemical that is banned both in the U.S. and in China. Could the sale of Smithfield actually have an effect on food safety standards here in the U.S.?
No, I don't think so. You know, I think that if anything, it's going to be, people are so worried that somehow the idea of the Chinese owning a large American company means that American companies are going to take this as license to decrease their own food safety standards, whereas it's been the opposite. There's a similar drug to clenbuterol, which indeed in 2011 sickened hundreds of people in China because their pigs were eating feed that was tainted with it. But they already outlaw a similar growth-promoting chemical called ractopamine, which the U.S. doesn't. And already eyeing the Chinese market, Smithfield had agreed and started to reduce by half the amount of pigs that were allowed to have ractopamine so that they could have access to these markets. So in certain ways, Chinese demands are much more stringent than U.S. demands. Another reason to be less alarmed, although I think there's lots of alarming aspects of this purchase, but another reason to be less alarmed is that the Chinese at the moment have absolutely no interest in exporting pork here, at least with this purchase. It's gaining access to more product for themselves and also to higher value product. So evidently, cut and processed meats, which Smithfield excels at and produces in much greater volume than Chinese companies that are the kind that go right into supermarkets and you get a much higher profit margin for, are much less produced in China, which does a much less refined and rawer form of meat processing. So again, it's the technology to make these high-value, high-margin products. And those are the ones that are going to make money for the Chinese firm, which has a lot of American capital behind it, which is a really interesting aspect of it that the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times and others and The Guardian have reported on how much venture capital from America is involved in this purchase. So in any case, they're getting access to a market for a higher value product than Chinese pork producers now sell and make.
Corby Kummer is a food writer and senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. He joins us from studios in Boston. You can join the conversation by calling 800-433-8850. How do you feel about a Chinese company owning local pork production? 800-433-8850. Or you can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Joining us now by phone is Patrick Evans Hilton. He is a food writer based in Norfolk, Virginia. He's the author of several books, including Smithfield, Ham Capital of the World. Patrick Evans Hilton, thank you for joining us.
Hello, thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Patrick, today Smithfield calls itself the world's largest pork supplier. How much meaning does this buyout have locally in Smithfield?
Well, it has a lot, not only economically, but also culturally. You know, a light, fluffy buttermilk biscuit that's split open and stuffed with an ethereal slice of country ham is one of our culinary calling cards in our area. It's not only something that we enjoy to eat, but more importantly, something that we really identify with culturally. And I don't think that a lot of people want to turn that biscuit over and see a made in China sticker on the bottom of it.
Patrick, for those who have not been to Smithfield, what is the town like?
It's literally Mayberry. It's a very small, quaint town. It was established in the early 1700s. In fact, Smithfield Foods owns Smithfield Inn, which has been an inn since 1752, and it's one of the places that can rightfully claim that George Washington slept there. There's a lot of small shops. There's a lot of folks there. It's a town of about 8,000 people, and somehow there's a tie to Smithfield Foods throughout the town, whether you actually work there or not, because they've been so good about philanthropic different endeavors and all too. Just recently, even paying $800,000, I believe, for public restrooms for tourists to enjoy downtown as they're shopping and dining.
800-433-8850. What do you think Smithfield Foods means to the state of Virginia? Give us a call or send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Patrick, what are Smithfield residents saying about this potential sale?
I think that everybody is very, first of all, just confused, you know, what is going to happen. There's always that that great unknown. I think that, you know, there are some people that wish things could have been handled a little bit differently. The mayor of Smithfield himself did not even hear it from somebody at Foods. They just call it Foods down here. He actually heard it breaking news on television. The town manager got a text from his wife that heard it on television. So I think that people are, you know, a little confused. I think they're also, and rightfully so, wary about what this shift in dynamics, the cultural shift at the company, potentially could have.
Patrick, the Smithfield Company has been operating in Smithfield since 1936, but today it has plants and it has workers around the world. How much of the Hampton Roads region is still, how many people, so to speak, in the Hampton Roads region are still employed by the pork company?
Well, there's about 3,800 people in Virginia that's employed by Smithfield Foods. So it does have an impact economically. But I think, too, because we think of the Smithfield name being so synonymous with something that's so culturally important to Virginia, that that's a factor, too, that has to be weighed in, even people's minds outside of this area, you know, too, when they start thinking about the food and foodways. And although Foods has been around since 1936, it really can be traced back to the very first labeled food product that was being sold on a wide-scale basis from the 1700s. Mallory Todd first produced country hams in Smithfield, sold for export. And so that lineage of buyouts and everything, really this company does go back to the 1700s.
Corby Cummer, I'd like to get back to you. American companies have taken advantage of relaxed labor laws in countries like China for manufacturing their products, but with Smithfield, a Chinese company could be offshoring pork production to the U.S. So how would regulations in the American meat industry be beneficial to a Chinese company?
Well, I'm glad you're getting back to all I think about when I think of Smithfield, besides what, you know, must be a very pleasant downtown, and my mouth was watering at the idea of the biscuit, despite the label that I might find on the bottom. But what I really think about is water cleanliness and worker safety.
Oh, we're going to get to that, but go ahead.
Okay.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
No, I'll let you get to that, but it's all you can think about when you think about both China and the U.S. is already U.S. environmental standards. There's so much the attitude of violate and then apologize and pay the fines rather than wait till you're inspected and start the right way. And in 1997, I've just been reading up, Smithfield received one of the largest Clean Water Act fines in U.S. history. That whole fine was 0.035% of 1 year's sales, $12.6 million. So how much of a difference is that going to make to companies in the future? And the hundreds of dead pigs in a Shanghai river tributary that was used for drinking water around the Shanghai area because they died and they were just being disposed of, the way millions of gallons of pig manure can inadvertently seep into water supplies. I believe that American companies try to segregate it. It just doesn't always work. And there are these accidents all the time. So it's the huge scale and the complete opposition of what we think of as the family farm and what Smithfield might promote in its beautiful Mayberry town versus what the reality of the conglomeration and mergers has been that has made Smithfield such a huge international player, and what the Chinese are doing now. We're seeing the demise of family farms all over the world, and this merger is just one more sign of it.
Patrick, Smithfield's pork producers, as Corby just pointed out, don't have the best reputation. The company has faced fines for polluting the Chesapeake Bay, as he mentioned. Criticism over how it treats immigrant labor and also undercover videos that show animal abuse. How has the pork company's name held up in its hometown?
Well, I think that there, you know, certainly there are two Smithfields, as Corby was saying. You do, a visitor doesn't scratch too far under the surface, and you do see that quaint Mayberry. Around here, folks do know about the violations, and it's one of those things, too, that if you have strong financial ties to Smithfield Foods, if you're a shop owner in town, if you work for the company, you accept it as fact. There, you know, are people that aren't so directly tied that are very concerned about, because when it goes into the Pagan River, that does feed right into the James River, which ultimately comes into the Chesapeake Bay. So there are people that are very, very concerned about that, and I think that that's another wariness that we have, since China doesn't have the best reputation. Obviously, they're going to uphold to American laws, but also, as Corby said, there's that doesn't always seem to really make much difference what a larger company sometimes wants to do anyway, when they're just going to get a smack on the wrist kind of fine.
Patrick Evans Hilton is a food writer based in Norfolk, Virginia. He's the author of several books, including Smithfield, Ham Capital of the World. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Corby Cummer about Smithfield in China. Corby Cummer is a food writer and senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. I'm Kojo Nand.
Good afternoon, I'm Jessica Jordan. We want to let you know that WAMU 88.5 and Wolf Trap are offering the chance to win tickets to see the National Symphony Orchestra perform Jerry Garcia Symphonic Celebration. Find out more information about it by visiting our website. Go to WAMU.org and click under events.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Garrett County Chamber of Commerce. The Deep Creek Lake area's mountains and rivers provide visitors with activities like whitewater kayaking, hiking, and camping. More information is at visitdeepcreek.com. From Cohen Media Group, presenting the new film, The Attack. It's a mystery, a political thriller, and a love story. An Israel-Arab doctor, devastated by his wife's death in a terrorist attack, uncovers a startling secret. In theaters Friday. And from Trader Joe's, offering fruit flows, ice pops made with fruit in five flavors, strawberry, coconut water, lime, Caribbean, and fruit frenzy. Store locations at TraderJoe's.com.
Think about the most extreme, intense heat you've ever experienced. Multiply it by 20, and welcome to the world of metal casting.
A mediocre sculpture cast in bronze will still look great and will still have an audience just because the material is so pretty.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and on the next Metro Connection, we'll check out masterpieces from the metal melting furnace at the University of Maryland as we usher in summer with a show we're calling Feeling the Heat. Join us Friday afternoon at 1 here on WAMU 88.5.
Welcome back to our conversation with Corby Cummer. We're talking about Smithfield Ghost of Shuang Wei. Corby Cummer is a food writer and senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Corby, Americans may be eating less meat, but in some cases, they're still paying more for it. Beef prices have soared due to droughts. Do you have any idea whether this buyout could affect food prices either at home or abroad?
I think that, if anything, because American pork consumption is lowering versus the steep rise in China and India, the companies that have rising middle classes, it's possible that an increased exportation of American pork could result in higher prices. I don't think that's cause for alarm because I'm one of those snobbish elitist foodies who thinks that you should be paying a slightly higher price if it has anything to do with better treatment of workers and more humane treatment of animals and, you know, hoping that the USDA's inspection service, the USDA, yesterday the Times had an op-ed citing a new report by the USDA of its own inspectors and talking about the desperate lack of inspection that the USDA's inspector general report has. For example, there were 110 million pigs processed in 2011 by 626 plants and serial violations of standards in plants that just kept working because the workers are undertrained. They work long hours. So if prices rising can mean a better treatment of workers, you know, I'm all for it. But in general, the trend is downward in meat consumption, partly because of health concerns, partly because of price in the United States. So a short-term price rise, I don't think, is going to be a huge curbing effect in whether Americans eat more or less pork. I think it's going to be trends in what people think is right for their health, and the news about red meat is just increasingly bad. Yeah, please.
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt. We got an email from Donna who said, tell me how this will help any of us in the USA or the citizens of China other than the investors. Many people are thinking of health factors and are trying to cut back on eating meat. We're trying to improve the conditions of livestock and should be trying to use less land for the use of raising livestock. So who does this sale benefit aside from the investors? And her sentiments seem to be simpatico with those of Jack in Silver Spring, Maryland. Jack, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Yes, thanks, Ojo. You know, I look at this as another example of basically the investor's money, having money, busy making money, and, you know, nobody doing a darn day's work to earn the money. You know, we've got a lot of people basically being undercut in this country all the time, selling the businesses down the road, selling the jobs down the road for a couple of percent on the bottom line for the stock market, which is great. We have a stock market that's like a giant, yet we've got, despite the statistic of people being measured as unemployment, we've been in a depression that, you know, has been more than 10% unemployment for years now. Yet we turn around and we let things like this, you know, keep going down. I'm kind of beside myself about it, and it's been a product line that I've used for years. I won't be buying any more Smithfield products, and quite frankly, I would encourage others not to. You know, talk about the pen, you know, the power of the dollar or the checkbook, if you will. I think people have an opportunity. You know, they wanted to buy Hershey chocolates out a few years ago. People said, no, we're not going to have any part of that. I think people need to stand up for the jobs. I mean, they say it's all going to be okay, everybody's going to keep their job, but you know that's only a short-term resolution until they look at the money and what it's costing and where is the cheapest way to go. And okay. Unfortunately, we have a, well, briefly, and I'll get off the line here, we do have a tendency to look at the bottom line before we look at basically the people that make the bottom line happen.
And Corby Comer Jack is not an elite food writer, but obviously he feels that this is really not about people or workers at all, but merely about investors.
I think anyone who's followed the sale is very aware of that, considering the offshore holding companies and the U.S. venture capital that is so much a part of this. So the issues that it raises are the control of the U.S. food supply going out of U.S. hands. We're about to be running, I think, on the website, a piece that draws a lot of attention to the state-by-state laws about how many acres of farmland in a state a foreign company is allowed to buy, because more and more prime farmland in the United States is falling into the hands of foreign companies. And in a free market, you know, that's just fine. There's nothing wrong with that. There shouldn't be anything protectionist. And I'm not saying that we should be Japan, which reserves an enormous amount of its land for rice production. And it causes all kinds of urban concentration and high food prices. I would never advocate that kind of protectionism, but I think it's something that a lot of U.S. citizens should be thinking about in the future as foreign capital starts buying up farmland and farms.
You mentioned Japan. Yeah. Brazil is also imposing strict rules on foreign companies that want to own farmland. But do you think the U.S. will ever consider imposing those kinds of regulations?
You know, I think it will, and I think that's going to be part of the conversation in the next few years, and something that more and more activists and, you know, libertarian lawmakers, for that matter, are going to become concerned about. Because farmland falling out of the control of the United States, I think, is different from, say, Rockefeller Center or huge, high-profile U.S. trophy properties falling out of the hands of the United States, because will we ever be able to control it again? Mm-hmm. And as we're hoping to control, to shift more and more land production to food in a much more sane way, that's less consolidated, that's more diversified, that can feed more people in a smaller, restricted local area by being more diverse, less monocropping. But if the prime farmland isn't even U.S.-owned anymore, it's not going to allow U.S. farmers, especially young farmers of the younger generation, any chance of getting a leasehold getting a career.
Well, Corby, one Smithfield investor has been encouraging Smithfield Foods to split itself up rather than accept the Shuang Wei buyout. Ultimately, how do you think that deal will sell?
Oh, yeah.
And would that be a better idea?
Sorry, no, I don't know about that split up, because it struck me as still financially driven, as opposed to in terms of investor returning any kind of diversification in land or restoring water standards or diminishing the scale of the farm industry industrial production that Smithfield represents. So I think the deal is going to go through, and that a lot of the U.S. lawmakers' objections that I've seen are so kind of out of the ballpark of what people really should be considering, which is environmental standards and worker humanity, the way workers are treated and the way animals are treated, as opposed to regulation. But those don't seem to be the objections that are being raised by lawmakers, and I think that deal is going to go through.
Allow me to go to David in University Park, Maryland. David, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kojo. I think it's possible that there might be two positives to come out of this deal, and I've thought about this quite a bit. The first one concerns China. China's economic development really is in desperate need of a regulatory food safety regimen that's relatively free of corruption. And we have that here. It's flawed, but we do have that. And if a bad actor like Smithfield can be grudgingly brought into compliance, as they have been here, I think that'll be a real good example in China as they attempt to build such a regimen there.
Okay, allow me to have Corby Kummer comment on that.
You know, I think it's a very valid point, and something I wanted to bring up is that part of the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was a triumph when it was passed a few years ago, but a complete tragedy in that it has never been sufficiently funded to be able to put into place. A very large part of that was foreign food safety standards. And installing USDA, and that's a different agency, but installing U.S. inspection plants for exportation of foods, including in China. And I'm pretty sure the FDA has already been supervising plants in China, but it's nothing like at the scale that the Food Safety Modernization Act envisions and that the FDA would like to be able to implement. Yes, we are importing more and more food, and when you look at farmed fish coming from Southeast Asia and China and the paltry amount of inspection it receives, as well as meat, there's lots of things to be alarmed about. But I would advocate for people to write into their congresspeople and say, fund the Food Safety Modernization Act.
Corby Kummer is a food writer and senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. He joined us from studios in Boston. Corby, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, what we can learn about Afghanistan from families making carpets in a remote village that you won't even be able to find on a map. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WAMU 88.5. I'm Jessica Jordan. It's 75 degrees now in Frederick, Maryland, 71 in Northwest D.C. Here's what's ahead next hour.
M.E. Thomas's life kept falling apart every few years, and she couldn't figure out why until she remembered something a coworker had said.
She said very nicely, "You might consider the fact that you are a sociopath." And it made sense in a way that nothing really before had.
Now she tells us about her memoir, Confessions of a Sociopath. That's next time on Tell Me More.
Tell Me More starts this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Woolly Mammoth Theater Company, presenting The Stupid Bird Play, Aaron Posner's contemporary remix of Chekhov's The Seagull. Directed by Howard Schalwitz, now through June 23rd. Tickets and information at woollymammoth.net. And from the National Biodiesel Board, biodiesel is here, aiming to grow and diversify the transportation energy portfolio. More information on biodiesel at americasadvancedbiofuel.com.
In today's forecast, cloudy skies. We'll have a slight chance of rain this afternoon with highs reaching around 80 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear skies. We'll get a break from the clouds. Lows in the upper 50s. Tomorrow, sunny skies, highs in the lower 80s. And looking ahead to your Friday, sunny skies, highs in the mid-80s. Now back to the Kojo Namdi Show.
It can seem at times like the world is always pouring into Afghanistan. For decades, it's been in a perpetual state of war, and lately it's been the venue of the longest-running conflict in American history. Stories from within Afghanistan, however, don't always flow the other way, even on days like today, as the Taliban makes overtures about peace talks. But the journalist Anna Batkin says we can find such insight in things as simple as the carpets made there, the handmade masterpieces that come from isolated villages and often end up in American living rooms and studies. Batkin recently spent 4 seasons in a rural Afghan village, weaving herself into the fabric of everyday life. She joins us today to share the stories she documented. Anna Batkin is a journalist and author. Her latest book is titled The World is a Carpet, 4 Seasons in an Afghan Village. She joins us in studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-433-8850. America has been at war in Afghanistan for more than a decade. Stories about this country have been on the news here regularly for year after year, yet there's little that connects the two places culturally. But in Carpets, you say you found something that connects the American audience to what goes on in small, remote villages there. What do you see when you look at one of these carpets?
I see human histories. I see a journey of a carpet weaver. A carpet in Afghanistan is made by an entire village. Everybody comes in and out of a loom room. The woman who's weaving the carpet will tend to her children. There will be goats who will amble into the room. There will be the noise of an F-18 fighter bomber overhead. There will be the echo of distant explosions. So everything that happens around the loom room is woven into that carpet.
You've been to Afghanistan many times during the course of the past decade. You've covered the war as a journalist from its earliest days. But for this book, you spent 4 seasons inside a rural village in the north called Oka, a village that does not appear on maps. What kind of place is Oka?
Oka is a tiny village of about 40 cob homes raised by hand out of clay on a small hillock in the northern plains of Afghanistan between the Oxus River, which we now call the Amu Darya, and the Hindu Kush. And if you stand in the village and look in any direction, you will see the world curving in onto itself. It's an epitome of the forgotten, the abandoned Afghanistan, which is where 80% of Afghans live. And the reason I chose to be there was because we hear a lot, or we see a lot of images, and we hear a lot of stories coming out of big cities in Afghanistan, because that's where, I guess, the cameras are. But big cities in Afghanistan are not representative of Afghanistan at all. Most Afghans live very rurally, hence Oka.
It is my understanding that carpet weavers there just earn just a few cents a day, at the most maybe $1 a day, for making masterpieces that often sell for tens of thousands of dollars in other countries.
That's correct.
How long does it take to make one of those carpets that someone here will buy for, $20,000?
Between 4 and 9 months, depending on how many women are working on it, depending on how many distractions there are. Sometimes the weaver will have to attend her sister's wedding in a different village, and so she will leave the loom and her carpet for a couple of weeks. And sometimes there will be extra hands, her daughters perhaps, or maybe her sisters come in to weave with her. So there will be extra help and extra speed in the weaving.
Can you walk us through the process of what connects a carpet from Oka, a place with no running water, no electricity, to a living room in the United States, starting from the hands of a woman like Tharwa, I think, a figure who is at the center of this book?
Well, you can look at it in different ways. You can look at the actual journey of the carpet from the moment when Thaura's father-in-law walks on foot to the nearest market town, which is about a 7-hour walk away, to buy the yarn for the carpet, and then brings it back. And then the entire family participates in creating the loom, which is a horizontal loom made out of 2 beams.
On which Tharwa will spend 7 months on that thing.
That's right. That's right. And a lot of things will happen on that thing. A lot of sex gossip will happen on that thing. A baby will be born on that thing. Chicken will hatch on that thing. There will be a lot of conversations. There will be tea that will be spilled onto that thing. So you can look at that sort of in a linear way as a thing being made, and then that thing, the carpet, is rolled into a tube and probably wrapped in a burlap sack and taken by donkey and then by taxi and then by bus to Kabul. And then from Kabul, it's stuffed into the cargo compartment of a plane and sent to Dubai and from there to London or to Washington, D.C. Or maybe it continues its journey to Pakistan. So that's the sort of the linear journey of what connects Thawraz Village and Thawraz Loom Room to the living room of probably people in our audience. But the other connection is a much deeper connection that we all share as humans, and that connection is in the sex jokes. That connection is in the way a four-year-old girl goofs off as she's trying to help her mom. You know, that connection is in the absolute humanity that we all share. And I think that that connection is woven into that carpet, and that is much more important than the actual yarn, the physical yarn.
We're talking with Anna Batkin. She is a journalist and author. Her latest book is titled The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. You can call us at 800-433-8850. Is there an Afghan carpet in your home? How often do you stop to consider where it came from and what life is like for the people who made it? 800-433-8850. Your book follows Thora and her family for four seasons. What can you tell us about them as a group? And as a journalist, how did you find that family? How did you get to know them and get them to open their lives to you in this way?
I was born in the global south. My global south was very far north at the 57th parallel in Leningrad, USSR. But I grew up in a place where in order to talk to somebody, you walked into their door and you sat down over a cup of tea, and the conversation would commence and people will open up to one another because everything outside that door was hostile. So for the last 17 years, I have been walking through these doors professionally as a journalist working in extremis. And yet, I'm always fascinated and humbled by how it is that I come in as a complete outsider and the reaction of my hosts is, oh, okay, well, my name is this. Please have a seat and let's have a cup of tea and we share stories. I was introduced to Baba Nazar, the patriarch of Thawraz family, by a friend who was working with me as a driver in 2010 in Afghanistan, who said, I've got to show you something. And he brought me to Akka. And it was one of the most destitute places in the world that I have seen. And I've traveled quite a bit in fairly destitute regions. And he introduced me to Baba Nazar. He said, this is Baba Nazar. He is a hunter. This is Anna. She's a journalist from America. And Baba Nazar extended his hand and said, welcome. Let me show you my house. And we walked through a door, which was actually a doorless cavity in his mud brick house. And there was his daughter-in-law weaving the most beautiful carpet I've ever seen. And that friction between the immense beauty and the absolute poverty and the war that was happening all around us as we were speaking, as we were drinking that tea, it pierced me. It made me want to stay as long as it takes to weave a carpet.
You studied the craft of carpet making fairly extensively, and one thing you notice is that at the other end of the spectrum, the dealers look specifically for mistakes, proof of human fallibility. Why was that significant to you?
Everything that proves that we're human is significant to me. My job, I think, in life is to connect, to mediate between people who live in the West, because this is where I live now, and this is where my audience is, and people in the global South, which is where I come from and where I work and where I spend most of my life and a giant portion of my working life. So anything that proves to my audience that people far away are not simply stick figures, two-dimensional, cartoonish characters in the backdrop of this American war or that American engagement. Anything that brings the background, or what American audiences very often see as background to American wars, to the foreground and says, look, these are deeply peopled landscapes. 30 million people live in Afghanistan, men and women and children, and they laugh and they fall in love and they fall out of love, and everything that humanizes, well, that's a very bad word, actually, because nothing humanizes. Anything that reminds humans on this side of the ocean that that side of the ocean is also populated by humans is very important to me.
And when we talk about human fallibility, it is my understanding from The World is a Carpet that the carpet maker deliberately does something to make the carpet not perfect, because only God can create perfection.
A very, very good carpet weaver who never gets distracted by her children's crying, who never stands up from the loom because somebody came in and she wants to embrace her. A very professional carpet weaver will weave mistakes into her carpet so as not to offend the perfection of Allah. But usually she doesn't need to think about that, because she will run out of thread. She will forget how many petals she has already woven because a goat has ambled into her room and she has to shoo the goat away. Or somebody told her a joke so vulgar that she is in fits of laughter, and once she recovers, she's forgotten and accidentally woven an extra line. So she doesn't need to worry really about, oh, I must make a mistake. She will make mistakes. It's almost inevitable.
On to the telephones. Here is Tom in Laurel, Maryland. Tom, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was in Afghanistan with the military in 2003, and one of the trips we had was to Samarkand, Uzbekistan. We went to a factory that made rugs, and the director of the factory was a medical doctor who mentioned the reason he was running the business is he had tried to do medical work in Afghanistan, but because he wasn't connected with an NGO, the expense was too much to his living expenses in Afghanistan. But what he had going on in Uzbekistan, there were two women at a loom, and it was like an apprenticeship program. And in Uzbekistan, there were a lot of protections for these folks, good working conditions, time off for maternity leave. Also, this medical doctor had a sister who was a medical doctor in Arizona, and she was sending patterns where the American Indians had, rugs that were put on walls, patterns that were no longer made, and they would duplicate those patterns, and he would sell them over the Internet. He sold, pointed out some flaws in some rugs, and gave the fellas discounts. Some of the guys that didn't have a check, he gave them the rug and said, send me the check. And I found this person to be very... in my mind, very, upstanding. And he said the real problem was the mulberry trees had been devastated in Afghanistan. And if they could only produce more mulberry trees, which facilitated the making of silk, that this industry could take off and you'd have, an increased economy for Afghanistan. I just want to comment on that.
I am fascinated by that, because I'd like to hear what Anna Bogdan says that would mean to the family in Oka.
I'm laughing at this story, Tom. Thank you very much for telling it, because you said that you were in Afghanistan and then there was a factory in Uzbekistan that was dealing with Arizona over the Internet. And mulberry trees, which of course grow on my street in West Philadelphia, and I go and pick some mulberries very often around this time of the year. They're now in season on this continent. Talking about human connections, it's all just in this one call. More mulberry trees would not help the weavers of Oka, because they weave wool carpets. They don't weave silk carpets.
So it would mean nothing to them. Tom, thank you very much for your call. A lot of people are trying hard to understand the psychology of the Taliban today with the news that the Taliban wants to move ahead with peace talks. You reviewed an anthology of Taliban poetry a few years ago for the New Republic, and you wrote that poetry is one of the most revealing sources of how Afghans actually feel. What do you think is so revealing about art, particularly when it comes to Afghanistan?
Afghanistan has been making art since the time before Europe was even a feudal part of the world. There is a grave not far from the village Oka, where I worked in 2011, of an Afghan woman poet named Rabia Balkhi, who in the 10th century composed poetry in both Arabic and Farsi. Alexander the Great, when he invaded Balkh in 327 BC, is rumored to have sent his mother Olympias a carpet from Balkh because it was so beautiful. So we may forget individual characters, individual people of Afghanistan, but what we will always remember because of historians and because of artifacts is the art of Afghanistan. And also, for me, the fact that Afghanistan produces some of the most beautiful, not just carpets, but poetry, pottery, jewelry in the world is very important, because we seem to forget that life continues in war. And so when we think of a war zone, we basically classify it as this hellish place where nothing good ever grows, everybody's dying, everybody's suffering. In fact, again, wars wouldn't be so horrible, to paraphrase General Lee, if they weren't waged in landscapes where people are producing art. So the juxtaposition of art and war, it's very important to remember, I think. It's very important to keep that art in mind, because it keeps persevering in the most direst of circumstances.
We're talking with Anna Bagden. She is a journalist and author. Her latest book is titled The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. After more than a decade of war in Afghanistan, how much do you know about the lives and cultures of the people who live inside that country? Give us a call, 800-433-8850, and send email to kojo@wamu.org. What's the relationship of a place like Oka to the central government of Afghanistan? How have the people in your book been shaped or not by the central government, by the Taliban, or anyone else's influence? Other authorities' influence, that's what I should say.
What is the relationship indeed of most Afghans to the central government of Afghanistan? So once I went to the provincial government of the province of Balkh, which is a northern province where Oka is situated, and asked a question about how come Oka doesn't have a teacher to teach the children of Oka. And the officials, there were several people sitting in the room, the head of the Department of Education and her assistants, and she said, Oka, where is that? And one man said, I don't know where that is. And the other man said, it doesn't exist. So in the eyes of the government of Afghanistan, most of the rest of Afghanistan probably doesn't exist, which is how come most of the rest of Afghanistan, 12 years into billions of dollars, $8 into the war, still has not seen almost any of the international assistance that the world is providing Afghanistan. Conversely, for the rest of Afghanistan, the central government doesn't really exist, because it doesn't do anything for the people of Afghanistan. So it's a very, it's a theoretical relationship.
Reminds me of a piece you wrote for Foreign Policy a few years ago where a driver from northern Afghanistan told you, we don't care about the government or the Taliban. Neither is going to look out for us or change our lives. We have to look out for ourselves. But last month, you wrote an article about American claims that the war effort has been helping the women of Afghanistan. You said essentially that progress has been uneven at best. What, in your view, are the things that can be done to improve lives for Afghan women in the long term after American troops withdraw?
Very little, to be honest. There is no easy solution. And because what Afghan women need is to have their basic human rights protected. The right to life, for example. 1 in 4 Afghan children dies before the age of 5. It's the highest infant mortality rate in the world. 1 in 8 Afghan women die in childbirth. That is also pretty high because they have no access to sanitation, no access to clean water, no access to health care, or very, very limited access to any of these things. So what Afghan women need is access to health care, access to sanitation, adequate nutrition, roads to take their beautiful carpets to market.
Not to mention adequate compensation for making their carpets.
Adequate compensation would probably follow if there were roads to which they could use to take their carpets to market rather than be limited to the one dealer who's a 7-hour walk away. You know, if I had a choice, maybe I would go to a dealer who's a little farther but would pay me a little better. And of course, Afghan women need security, and that is something I just am not seeing in the future of Afghanistan.
We're almost out of time, but it's my understanding that your next stop is Mali. When can we expect to start seeing stories from there?
Well, I'm working in Mali right now. I'm herding cattle with Fulani nomads, and there is a book that's supposed to come out in 2015.
Anna Bakhtin is a journalist and author. Her latest book is titled The World is a Carpet, 4 Seasons in an Afghan Village. Anna Bakhtin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nnamdi Show, we explore the heavy toll on those caring for a family member and resources that can help. Then at 1, the Battle at Gettysburg, how a cornerstone of the Civil War and a touchstone of American identity continue to shape our nation. The Kojo Nnamdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Trader Joe's, offering Fruit Flows, ice pops made with fruit in 5 flavors, strawberry, coconut water, lime, Caribbean, and fruit frenzy. Store locations at TraderJoe's.com. And from the DC Chamber of Commerce Policy Forum,